Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Moray v'rabotai, as the years go by, and more of the teachings of the Rav are seeing the light of day, in some cases, it is the words of the Rav himself. In others, it is filtered through the notes and memories of devoted Talmidim. But for all of it, all of us are grateful. In one respect, however, it seems to me that the situation has not improved much from what it was during his lifetime. Here and there, there still reigns considerable confusion. And I'm referring to the question, how do you classify or categorize the Rav and the nature of his Torah teaching? How does the Rav fit into the traditional framework of Torah greats? And I believe you have to ask this question if you really wish to appreciate the Rav's special contribution to Torah learning. To keep repeating that he was unique does not help very much, for without a context, you haven't really said anything. Of course, the source of the problem is that the Rav was superbly great in diverse areas, which in our tradition, certainly in modern times, have rarely come together in one person. Admirers of the Rav would like to know, essentially, Be'ikar, who was the Rav? Man of halakha or man of faith? Briska Lamdan or existential philosopher? And to say that he was both, Gamze v'Gamze, doesn't really answer the question. You could, of course, say what they used to say of the Rambam, also a man of halakha and philosophy, that you should follow the advice of the Mishnah. Asei lecha Rav. Let each person make up his own image of the Rav. Let each one emphasize the element of his own liking, and then we can all live happily ever after. But before I get to the substance of my talk, let me suggest an approach which has been helpful to me in positioning the special place and genius of the Rav. Let us revert to the traditional nomenclature, the division of the material in the Torah to halakha and agadah, and notice there's no special department here for philosophy. The halakha being, as we all know, all of the actionable, doable, obligatory mitzvot, rules and principles, the agadah being all the rest, the narratives, the poetry, the songs, the prayers, the theological propositions. And of course, both halakha and agadah are integral parts of Torah Hashem. And in the last analysis, conventional wisdom to the contrary notwithstanding, who can say which is the more important? Chazal received a special methodology called Midrash Darshanut, by which to extract, to mine from the rich ore of the Torah Shebichtav by means of rules and interpretation, the meaning and implications of the text. But this method of Midrash was different for halakha than it was for agadah. For halacha, the midot shehatorah nidreshet bahem were more restricted, formal, and rigorous. The overriding component was logic and reason, and the approach essentially analytic. Whereas the rules of Midrash Agadah were freer, imaginative, creative, with more room for input from the mind of the student. The result of the work of Chazal, using these methods of Midrash Halacha and Agadah, is, of course, the massive legacy known as rabbinic literature, found in the Mishnah, the Talmudim, the works of Midrash Halakha, and Midrash Agadah. The point is that these divisions and methodologies remained the general framework within which the bulk of subsequent Torah scholarship took place, even after the Chatimat HaTalmud. The area of the Halakha received most attention because of the pressure of the practical need to arrive at accepted norms of behavior. This took the form of codification, response to literature. Chidushei Torah in Halakha continued using traditional methods of analysis based on logic and analogy. However, in the area of Agadah, where there was no need to arrive at a consensus, pluralistic and even contradictory interpretations were tolerated. And so, popular preachers in their drashot were free to use their literary imagination and exhortatory skills in interpreting biblical texts as well as the Agadot of the Talmudic sages. Only in certain particular periods where the Jewish community faced serious challenges from aggressive philosophies both domestic and foreign, were special works on Jewish philosophical themes undertaken by Sadia and Maimonides, and for example also by others and by Yehuda Halevi. Now generally, however, whatever Jewish thinkers had to say in areas which we today would consider philosophical, or aspects of Hashkafah, or psychological insights which were important for the teaching of Musa, all this was conveyed in the form of Midrash Agadah, as Darshanut, interpretations of the non-halachic portions of the Torah. I suggest that the contributions of the Rav be considered within this traditional framework. Clearly the Rav came from and remained within the framework of the yeshiva world, by which I just don't mean the Lojin, but Surah and Pumbedisa and Yavna and Bnei Brak. And his work is to be seen and evaluated in terms of halacha and agadah, while what we call his philosophy should be subsumed under the subject heading Midrash Agadah. Now, only foolish people will see this as demeaning. Chalila. But this is the best way to appreciate and understand the Rav and the nature of his work. True, the Rav read and mastered, and here I don't exaggerate, the entire history of philosophy, which is to say, was rather unusual in a Rosh Yeshiva. But after all, what is philosophy? It is not name-dropping. It is not, as some people think, the ability to associate a certain name with a certain system of philosophy. That's knowing the history of philosophy. But that's not philosophy. It is the grappling of the human mind with the broadest and most basic questions that face human existence. Questions such as, what is knowledge? How do we get to know? And what can we know? What are values? How do they differ from facts? What is the nature of man? And how does he differ from other forms of life? How does science work? And what can it tell us about the universe? The Rav was interested in all of these questions and had absorbed the best that the world philosophic community had to say about them. What he had acquired was not stam information, but an entire array of concepts, terms, insights, distinctions regarding all of these above questions from all the schools of philosophy, from Plato through to existentialism and phenomenology. And so, equipped with these concepts, and with his tremendous power of depth analysis, the Rav is able to penetrate the deepest layers of religious consciousness if he is treating Agadah, or the basic concepts or underlying a sugya or a machloket if he is studying halacha. The Rav was not a committed neo-Kantian philosopher, shtuyot, nor a follower of existentialism. But he should rather be seen as a traditional Talmud Chacham, possessed of unusual analytic power, introspective ability, the eye of an artist, a sense of the theatrical, and the descriptive power of a poet. Such a combination we have never had before. Essentially, he knew how to apply the ideas he had absorbed from the history of philosophy to do Midrash Halakha and Midrash Agadah. This is clearly seen in the form of the Darshanut that his best-known writing takes. For example, in order to understand the man of faith, you must first learn the first few prokim of Bereshit. This is Parshanut, Darshanut. And if you want to understand the philosophy of Ubikashtem Misham, that is presented as a midrash on Shir HaShirim, And he again uses this theme in Kol Do Di Do Fek. Now, understanding this helps us to explain the difficulty we have when we try to disconnect. And we're always trying to do that. What is the philosophy of the Rav? So you'll start this, Adam 1 and Adam 2. I don't want to know Adam 1. Don't give me, I want to know, what is the philosophy of the Rav in the history of man? What is this philosophy of man? You're going to have difficulty when you try to disconnect the philosophy from the Darshanut. Try to give a description of the Rav's view of the Jewish man of faith without going into the distinctions between Adam 1 and Adam 2. And then the question arises, did the Rav derive his philosophy from the text, or is he simply using the text to illustrate his philosophy? If it is the former, then the validity of his philosophy would seem to depend on the validity of his parshanut. If it's the latter, then what is the authority of his philosophy? Of course, the answer to the question like that lies deep in the metaphor of Kepatish Yefotzei Sela. And whoever can know the pshat in Kepatish Yefotzei Sela will begin to know the answer to this question. My friends, I offer my talk here this afternoon as an example of what has to be done in order to discover the view of the Rav on a particular philosophical question. And I leave you to be the judge whether I'm successful or not. Now, the subject. What was the Rav's approach to belief in God? Now, admittedly, the wording of this title sounds a bit awkward. What's that? The question of the Rav's approach to belief in God? The short answer is, of course, that the Rav was definitely in favor of belief in God. Seriously, however, the issue I wish to raise is whether a believing and practicing Jew who considers himself rational ought to be prepared to justify, at least to himself, why he believes in and why he remains committed to God and his Torah. Is there evidence in the writing of the Rav of his views on this question? Now let me clarify the question. Why do I believe in God? This question is ambiguous. It could be construed as asking for causes, which could be answered by saying, because I was raised as an Orthodox home. I believe in God because I had an inspiring, charismatic Rebbe. But that is not what we are looking for. We are not looking for causes. We are looking for reasons. What are the reasons for believing this? We are looking for a rational justification. And to put it a bit more technically, what is the epistemological basis for belief in or faith that God exists? How do you know your belief is true? How do you distinguish between true and false beliefs? And should a Jew even be concerned by this kind of a question? Now, simply to proclaim Ani Ma'amin Be'Emunah Shleima, even with complete honesty and sincerity, is to merely report about one's own state of mind. For example, I am truly convinced that certain things exist, or that certain events took place. Or, I am convinced that I have complete trust in something or in somebody. But as a rational individual, one must also ask, and you have to ask this because sometimes your life may depend upon whether your belief is truly rational and correctly based, do I have a right to have such convictions? Yes, I am convinced, Ani Ma'amin. Do I have a right to have such convictions? Am I justified in having such trust? And this is necessary because how else can we distinguish between false beliefs generated by superstition, ignorance, or gullibility, and true beliefs that we ignore at our peril? After all, credulity is not a virtue. It is the petty that is yamin l'chol davar. Many, of course, would agree that in special circumstances, okay, it might be useful to be able to give such reasons. What kind of circumstances? For example, we know somebody who until now was a believer, but now he's beginning to waver. Or, we know somebody who until now was not a believer, and he's now beginning to show some interest. Would it not be helpful to be able to discuss, to direct,
to show why there are good reasons to believe that there is a God and that this is his Torah. But putting aside these pragmatic, practical considerations, should a person who has no doubts feel it necessary to probe and search for the rational basis of his religious beliefs? The question of the relationship between faith and reason had already been debated by our Jewish theologians in the Middle Ages, although it took a different form. The then conventional wisdom held that the basic truths of religion should be established by deductive arguments leading from self-evident principles. These, it was believed, constituted actual rational proofs, conferring certainty that could be logically demonstrated in fact. Now, Sadia, as well as Bachia, had claimed that the acquisition of truth by rational means was for every Jew an actual mitzvah. It wasn't just you're allowed to do it. It was an actual mitzvah. And even Yehuda Halevi, who denied the possibility of attaining rational certainty in the sphere of metaphysics, he argued that belief in the existence of God and the actuality of revelation could be justified rationally. You see, but this is precisely the point. Granting that revelation provides us with truths we could never otherwise attain, how could we be sure that revelation ever took place? Indeed, so long as religious faith is based upon events that happened in the past, there will always be the question, how do we know? How can I be sure that these things really happened? Are we therefore compelled to conclude that religious truth must, at least initially, be seen as a sort of historical truth in which we must demonstrate the veracity of the tradition, the reliability of the documents, and the evidence that attest to these events? Now, it should be noted that in Tanakh, this problem seems never to have come up, although those spokesmen for God are perfectly aware of the possibility of encountering skepticism and disbelief. Moshe argues, what do I do? Hey, ain't lo yaminu bi. They may not believe me. So Moshe was aware that it's possible for people not to believe. But they themselves, the spokesmen, they are never in doubt of God's existence or of the authenticity of their message. Now, how come? It would appear that the basis of their belief was their personal, direct, and immediate experience of an overwhelming, transcendent being whose reality was self-evident. It was an experience whose authenticity was self-validating. And perhaps then this is the key to the problem of rational justification. Maybe religious belief or faith is precisely that sort of thing that doesn't need any justification. Okay, but what was the view of the Rav? In his early philosophic monograph, The Halachic Mind, written in 1944 but first published unchanged in 1976, the Rav refers to this issue in a footnote, and I quote what he says there. The problem of evidence in religion will never be solved. The believer does not miss philosophic legitimation. The skeptic will never be satisfied with any cognitive demonstration. In some cases, the religious person is so overwhelmed by the import of his experience that he very distinctly perceives the reality of his object. In other words, the believer sees, it's not only I believe, well, this is the state of my mind, I have actually had an encounter, an experience with the transcendent being, with Hashem. He is fully conscious of the existence of the transcendent order, unquote. In another, more expansive footnote in The Lonely Man of Faith, the Rav paraphrases the sarcastic reaction of Kierkegaard, when he heard that Anselm had prayed fervently to God to be able to prove God's existence. In other words, here is a man praying to God and saying, please God, show me the way to prove your existence. So the Rav says, does the loving bride in the embrace of her beloved ask for proof that he is alive and well? Must the prayerful soul clinging in passionate love and ecstasy to her beloved demonstrate that he exists? However, a fuller expression of the Rav's view of the nature of religious belief is to be found in his essay, Ubikashta Misham. There, as we have already indicated, he uses the dialectical nature of the relationship between the lovers in Shir HaShirim as the framework within which to sketch the entire history of religious philosophy, but not in terms of belief or disbelief, but in terms of seeking and finding. This is already very, very crucial. The question of God, of man's relationship with God, is not a question, do you believe or don't you believe? The question is, have you looked for him and have you found him? It's seeking and finding. In Lauder with Dirshu Hashem Behimatso, or Dirshuni Vechyu. Because, says the Rav, man is created B'Tzelem Elokim, there is within him, whether he realizes it or not, an intimation of a higher power, a turning towards him, even a hunger and a yearning for fellowship, for holiness. And correspondingly, the Creator God seeks to be known by man. Sporadically, Hashem is not passive in this searching and finding. Hashem leaves hints and clues, footprints and echoes, and sometimes reveals himself to those who seek him. Now, according to the Rav, the entire period of the Middle Ages, during which theologians of all the revealed religions sought to prove the existence of God by means of deductive reasoning, that, says the Rav, in origin was an expression of their seeking. It wasn't stam. Here is the whole, the half the world that believes in revealed religion are engaging in this theological work. And he says, but what was the motive? What was behind it? It was they are Nebuch, seeking for God. In the modern period, it was conclusively shown that, and here I use the words of the Rav, time-bound human reason is not competent to build categories that could establish the truth of some infinite, supersensible reality. In other words, this whole project of trying to prove God, and how do you do it? By some sort of deductive reasoning, by logic, that is bilti efshari. It's a blind, it doesn't go anywhere, it can't be done. So that there are no logically ordered steps which could lead from features within the world to that which transcends it. However, says the Rav, this does not mean that these classical proofs are completely worthless. Doesn't mean, okay, you can't prove the existence of God, so take the whole literature and all their attempts and chuck it in the ash can. He says, no, they're not worthless. Why? Originally, says the Rav, they were based upon important insights which started out simply as living personal experiences. And today, they can still be helpful by pointing us in the direction of certain areas of human experience which we may explore in the hope of finding traces of the divine. Thus, the so-called ontological proof, one of the first so-called proofs for the existence of God was something called ontological proof. Ontology meaning being. Says the Rav, that should lead us to explore not the ontological proof, there is no proof, but since they were working in the area of ontology, which is being, says the Rav, it's a hint that we have to start looking in the area as an experience. Look for the ontic experience, as he calls it. Look for the ontological experience. And if one of the great proofs was the cosmological proof of the existence of God, says the Rav, okay, it's no proof anymore, but start looking for the cosmic experience. There could be an ontic experience, and there's a cosmic experience. All these things are things which take place within the consciousness of the human being. Now, the further problem of the proofs was, even if they had been valid, let's say that they had been correct, and you did find God, quote, G-O-D, at the conclusion of a logically argued syllogism, it would still only be a word. Conclusion, ergo, there is a God. Was das dort? G-O-D, what's that? A word, a verbal token, an empty abstraction. However, if you stop looking for proofs, which is futile, and you begin to look into your own life for experiences, an experience with your total being, you then may encounter a living reality, which will turn out to be the presence of God. This is possible, says the Rav, because, and I quote, eternity, says the Rav, is accessible to human intuitive apprehension. Although it's in a completely different order, the spiritual, von deswegen, it is possible for the human being to, in some way, using his, what he can't call it understanding, but his apprehension, he can work through and penetrate and get a touch with the reality, which is Hashem. Now, the Rav finds the source for this view in the disclosure by God to Moshe. When Moshe asked, what is your name? If the people ask me at the snap, what is your name? What shall I tell them? And there Hashem answers, of course, Eyeh Asher Eyeh. Now the Rambam interprets this, Eyeh Asher Eyeh, to mean the following. I quote, behold, I am absolute necessary existence, which implies that wherever you will find being, it is only a reflection of my infinite necessary existence. I'll bet you never thought that that's what Eyeh Asher Eyeh means. Because certainly not what Rashi says. But the idea here of being, the Rav calls this revelation to Moshe a new doctrine. In other words, if you want to know what was the new idea that the Torah had to offer the world in terms of who is this God, the Rav says, there it is. It's an Eyeh Asher Eyeh. And he says this is the basis for the Rambam's famous opening words in the Mishneh Torah. And I quote, we all know this, Yesod HaYesodot V'Amud HaChachamot Leida. The foundation of everything is to know Sheyesh Sham Matsui Rishon. There is an original existent for whom Mamzi Kol HaNimtza. In other words, it's not a passive thing. The God's existence is that which makes possible all other existence. If you're here, and I'm here, and we're all here, it is because the basis of our existence is Hashem. V'chol ha-nimtzayim ha-shamayim v'oretz o'ma sh'beinehem lo nimtzu ela me'amitat himatz'o. V'im yal el adat shehu eina matzui, ein davar echad yachol lehimatzot. Now, this is the way the Rav interprets this sentence. He says like this, and I quote, creation is the separation of something from the lap of the infinite. Now you got to be medayik here, the Lashon. I don't know if anybody else who speaks English in such a, it's combined technically philosophical and it's poetic. You don't find that anyplace else. He says, the ongoing existence of the world apart from God is impossible. Divinity is pure being who brings all into existence, that encompasses all. There's a lot of Kabbalah here. God's relationship to the world is not summed up merely by the term cause and effect. God is the cause of the world. So the idea is, so the carpenter is the cause of this shtender. Where's the carpenter? He's not here anymore. But the shtender continues to exist. Says the Rambam and the Rav, God is the creator of the world in the sense that, if you can even imagine this, you can't, but if Hashem should cease to exist, everything else would collapse into nothingness. Every minute of the time, we're here because Hashem is pumping, as it were, existence, being, into our vitziyut. But rather, by a constant outpouring of being, the relative creature is hewn out of the rock of the absolute. There is no existence without God and no reality that is not grounded in God. Therefore, God draws after himself the creature. There's an interaction that continues to go on. Moshcheini acherecha narutza. Hashem continues to draw the creature who feels the emptiness and dependence of his own finitude, and he yearns for an existence that is complete and whole. The unmediated ontological awareness acknowledges there is no existence without God. Now, though the Rambam calls this to know God, Yesoda Yesodot Leida, to know, the Rav points out that in reality, such apprehension, and I quote, transcends the bounds of the abstract logos, passes over to the realm of the boundless, intimate, and impassioned experience, where postulate and deduction, discursive knowledge and intuitive thinking, conception and perception, subject and object are one. You see why you got to go to college. Since man is an existing being, and God is in the profoundest sense the abiding ground of all existence, we have here the theoretical basis for the idea, and just as you find throughout the works of the Rav, he keeps referring to this, ontological awareness. Ontological awareness. That somehow man may be able to apprehend in his own existence. We all exist. I mean, the basis has already been given. We are all existing creatures. If we'll be able to analyze and to penetrate deeply into our own being, we will find the connection to that which is the ground of all being, and that is Hashem. Now, what does the Rav tell us about the actual content of the ontological awareness? Now, let me try to reconstruct the subject of awareness from the scattered references in the Rav's writing, and I try to put them in some sort of sequence. They appear to be a series of discrete, antithetic, yet mutually interacting feeling states. Now, somewhere they should be, I've given out papers. Some of you have those. I've called from different writings of the Rav, different citations where he refers to this ontological awareness, whatever it is. Now, as I say, it's a word, ontological. I can try to define it from today until tomorrow, and I don't know if it'll be much more, we'll be better off. But here, we have, these are citations from the Rav, and let's read it together quickly and see if you could find, in your own experience, some kind of empathy, some kind of feeling for what these states are. Now, where did the Rav get all of this? Well, it's true he did read the existentialist literature and so on, but I think the point is that no matter what you read in books, particularly in the area of how people feel or different feelings, unless you can find in your own consciousness, in your own experience, various feelings that correspond to it, then you don't know what they're talking about. In other words, the Rav had to confirm everything he might have read and in his own subjective feeling. So that here you see again the tremendous ability of the Rav, first for introspection. All of this he is culled out of his own consciousness. Okay, there are a lot of people who may feel, but Rabotai, where do you get the words, the vocabulary, to put it in, like you'll see here? Let's go over this very quickly. One, the plenitude of overwhelming power and beauty in the world, in all of its complexity, vastness, law-like uniformity, variety, novelty, and fecundity, of which I am an integral part. Here the Rav, in practically one sentence, sums up what it is to be, to live in this world. I mean, what is this world? Complexity, vastness. I mean, you could write an essay on each one of these words. What it is to be, to feel the teva in nature, to feel part of this world. Not to sit in a grubby office and to sit, look at a computer all day. That's not living. That's not being aware. To go out into the world and to be aware of all of these aspects of which I am an integral part. So man feels he is, I am a part of this tremendous world. And it's something vast and mysterious. Secondly, I and other human beings am superior to much of all this by virtue of my being a subject, conscious and appreciative of what I perceive. In other words, there's the whole world out there, I'm a part of this world, but there's a vast difference between all that out there and me. Namely, only I, not the sun and not the moon and not the molecules, can appreciate and is conscious. I mean, consciousness is one of the greatest gifts that life and human, that existence can give us. To be conscious of where, that's the whole difference between alive and dead. And for being able to communicate with and relate to other human beings. Okay, these two first points, Rabotai, there's nothing special about it. I mean, the way it's put, of course, is wonderful, but These are normal experiences that any person who begins to just think a little about who I am and where I am will feel. Now the Rav begins to develop the theme. Three, okay, I'm special, right. But so what does it mean to be special? I am unique, alone, finite, and dependent. I know that I did not make myself or the world around me. I am subject to a frightening time consciousness. A frightening time consciousness. What does this mean? Says the Rav, I know of an endless past which rolled on without me. I know that there will be an endless future which will rush on long after I am dead. I mean, just think about that. Schapta pachad. There's this whole world that's been going on, they say, for a long time. What is my role in this? At a certain little point in time, I was born. Mazel tov. I'm here. And then, after a while, but what happened? Where was the world even before? I can read about it in history books. But just the idea that for thousands of years there were people and living and dying and doing and achieving, that all went on without me. Evidently, you know, the world can get along without me. Now that I'm here, okay. But then I realize that long after I am dead, this world will continue. Now this is what the Rav means by time consciousness. How accidental and insignificant am I, says the Rav. Four, what is it to be, says the Rav. To be is a unique in-depth experience and means. What is it to be or not to be? That is the question. We all know this from Shakespeare. But what does it mean to be? A in-depth experience means to be the only one, singular and different, and consequently lonely. And of course, here Rav emphasizes the theme of the lonely man of faith. People like to forget that. Okay, the Rav is a man of faith that we accept. Every Jew is supposed to be a man of faith. But what is this lonely business? Hasidim certainly don't like to feel that the man is lonely. They have their Rebbe and so on. Now, but the I, says the Rav, the I is lonely, experiencing ontological incompleteness and casualness. The I begins to feel, I'm not mushlam, not in an ethical sense, but somehow my whole being is lacking here, shleimut. I feel alienated and estranged, cut off from nature and society. Mamela from nature, he said before, we're cut off because we are the only ones who are conscious, but also from society. Why do we feel cut off from society? I no longer experience a satisfying sense of belonging to the various collectives of which I am considered a member. Family, nation, party, workforce, and so on. I feel that I am in exile. Now, this also is considered to be a rather recent experience that people are having. It was thought that in the olden times, if you ask the person, who are you? Who are me? I'm a member of this family. I'm a member of this nation. I'm an American. I'm an Israeli. I'm a member of the Socialist Party. I'm a member of Likud. That's who I am. A member of the collectives. Says the Rav, but the time has come when people realize that this is no longer satisfying. Doesn't tell me who I am. It doesn't tell me who the essence of my being is. The pasuk says, Ger anochi va'aretz. And the Rav says, we all begin to feel that we are in exile no matter where we are. I am not my own, but feel under some authority. Now here, the plot thickens. Here we begin to add some additional feelings. That is to say, not everybody feels this, but did you ever feel that, I never made any promises to anybody maybe, but nevertheless I feel that I'm under some kind of authority. That is to say that I'm going to have to answer to something for my actions. Maybe if I don't believe, why should I believe that I have to give an accounting to anybody? The answer is that this should be part of your ontological awareness. You begin to feel that I owe something to somebody. Why? I'm here. Is it a gift? The very fact that I am here is mechayev oti to think that maybe I ought to be doing something. You mean I just got a free lunch? You mean I was put here, stam, to do anything I want? Somehow the person begins to feel that I owe something to somebody. I have to become something. I ought to be somebody, which I am not now. And then the Rav goes on to this, which is really his most impressive piece, number six. The Rav says, I have a thirst for something, but I know not what. God reveals himself to man in his very striving and yearning. Why does man not know tranquility? Why does he seek that which he cannot find in the world? It is God who is drawing man to himself. Man is tired, exhausted. He is not satisfied with his life or his achievements. He is perplexed. He gropes along the byways of his existence. This is the Rav talking, my friends. You can say, was the Rav, who should have been most satisfied with his existence and with his achievements and the Rav? The Rav is saying, but this is a human quality. That which he wants most, he does not achieve. Yet failure in his search does not prevent him from continuing to seek. This thing, says the Rav. Now, here you have the diagnosis. The thing which keeps pushing and pulling people, that they are not happy, they are not satisfied. Before the existentialist philosophy, people thought, oh, if I'm always depressed, that means I need a psychiatrist. What the existentialists came along and said, no, don't feel bad. That's the way human beings are supposed to feel. Because there is nothing in life that could possibly satisfy you. Why? Because as a Tzelem Elokim, you were born for something else, for something better, for something different. And that yearning, that thirst that you have for something is really Hashem, spirit that's calling on you as a human being to go find that alone which can satisfy you. And that is the presence of Hashem. This is nothing, says the Rav, but a thirst for God to communion with him. So that the ontological awareness soon becomes identical with transcendental awareness. Now the Rav continues. He says it is impossible to speak and to think and to deliberate about existence without living and feeling the source of existence. All right, I'm going to skip that rest of that. Let's go to 8. And now he says something very important, and that is that people begin to have a consciousness of interacting and establishing a relationship with a higher power that is experienced as objective and outside the self. It is endowed with volition, overwhelming power, majesty, holiness, and goodness. I sense this holy other, says the Rav, in, through, and under. Sometimes it's not a direct experience, but you experience it in, through, and under things and events in my life. It's the plus that sometimes exists after you've had an experience. And finally, says the Rav, I am endowed with conscious freedom and the ability to adopt my own leading principles. A person, and this is also to be human, is to be conscious of one's freedom. Bechira chafshit. I can organize my life around the principles that I choose, transform given reality into something different. This ability generates within me an awesome sense of responsibility and great anxiety. Judaism declares that man stands at the crossroads, wonders about the path he shall take, before him is an awesome alternative, the image of God or the beast of prey. And it is up to man to decide and choose. Now, all right, now, if we try to put all this together, what is the Rav trying to say here? And what do we say if we put together these different elements? The logically restructured sequence of experiences is therefore to be seen as follows. Once a person has a sense of the presence of the absolutely real, as the absolutely holy and supremely good, there immediately follows a sense of the partial nothingness and impotence of all relative being, thou all, I nothing. However, once man begins to reflect that he is still a positive entity, I am not utterly nothing. I have been privileged to stand before God, to recognize him, and to be recognized by him, then he begins to experience his own creatureliness. That is to say, I begin to realize that I am a creature. I have been created by something. I am a part of, grounded in, the absolute reality and the supreme goodness that makes possible my existence. The paradox of individual existence becomes understandable. I am indeed far from home and on alien territory. Therefore, I experience these profound anxieties, dread, threat of non-being. Now, let us return to our original question. According to what has been said, I would think that the Rav would have no problem in having a believing and practicing Jew ask himself why he believes in and is committed to God. For it could only lead to him discovering, if he did not already know it, that he had established a relationship with a higher power. This is because, according to the Rav, the epistemological basis of faith in God is immediate experience in which the individual, and I again quote him, perceives the reality of his object. He is fully conscious of the existence of the transcendent order. Thus, the person who has analyzed his ontological awareness in depth has no need for reasons and certainly not for proofs. Is there then no role for reason in the belief process? I quote the Rav, the intellect does not chart the course of the man of faith. Its role, says the Rav, is an a posteriori one. In other words, it attempts after the fact, ex post facto, to retrace the footsteps in the man of faith. Now, there's one final point that I'd like to make where I wish to suggest that nevertheless, as a matter of fact, the Rav does employ reason to do more than simply retrace the man of faith's footsteps. And I want to give you an example of how the Rav does engage in a kind of reasoning to try to convince us of the reasonableness of accepting his approach, which is that you can rely on religious experience. Consider the following statements of the Rav. There is a statement from the Rav to be found in Ubikashta Misham, and there he says as follows. He says like this, if there is a world, and in this there is no one who has doubt, then there is a God who is the rock and source of all being. And then he says again, if there is an I, and this too is known to man with certainty, then there is a living personal God who fills the I awareness. Now, vasidos. On the face of it, this looks like a logical argument of the type called material implication, of the if P, then Q form. In other words, if the antecedent is true, then the conclusion must be true. Is the Rav then using here a logical argument to prove the existence of God? It sounds like the good old cosmological proof. If there is a world, then there must be a God. Why? To explain how it got here. Because otherwise, from nothing, nothing can come. So if originally there was nothing, then there can never be anything. If there is anything, something, then it's the charaya, that there must be somebody who brought it into existence, therefore there must be a God. This is called the cosmological proof. However, I don't think that was the intention of the Rav. In order to understand the intention of the Rav, we must digress a moment and consider the teaching of a Max Scheler, a thinker whom the Rav refers to very favorably several times in his writing. Okay, Scheler said that he thinks that everything has to be justified. Every belief has to be justified, but the kind of justification depends on what kind of material you're dealing with. Not every justification has to be a proof. You can have truth, and you can arrive at truth and be certain about truth without having to prove these things. And where do you see that this is possible? Says Scheler, there are certain supersensible, he calls it, or asensible, ideas which are the following: space, concept of space, concept of time, value qualities, and the unity of the world and the unity of the self. What does he mean by these last two things? This is important. By the unity of the world is meant the belief that there exists an external world that is an environment independent of myself of which I must take account. This is part of our ordinary experience of which we are certain. It is primary, irreducible, unprovable, and has been called cosmic consciousness. Okay? In other words, there's an outside world. Can you prove it? No. Philosophers have tried. It cannot be done. Nevertheless, everyone is certain that out there is a world, and it's a very, you can't overcome it. It's there. What do you mean by unity of the self? Again, this is something that is part of our ordinary experience. My consciousness of being an I, pure subject, which is an abiding center of consciousness, the seat of my identity, which I experience as, hey, who is the real I? Who is the one that is making decisions? Who is the one that does things, that is the agent? Where is it? Can I ever get a glimpse of this I? Very difficult. I experience it as willing, deserving, striving, and choosing. But philosophers say there's no way in which you can prove the existence of the self. Now, just as in these two special cases, unity of self and unity of the world, we seem to have knowledge, because we're certain, which is given directly to our consciousness as primary data, which we treat as certain, although there's no proof, so too, says Chela, we can believe justifiably in God on the basis of our religious experience, even though there is no certainty. And that is why, by the way, the Rav, if you recall before, adds, if there is a world, and then he adds, and there's nobody that doubts it, if there is a unity of an I, there's nobody that doubts it, why throw, if this was just a logical deduction, what? It's not relevant whether people believe it or not. In other words, the Rav here is trying to give us a kind of argument, just like Scheller, which is to say that we use that as an analogy. And he's trying to give us here a rational argument, which is as follows. He's drawing an analogy between the conditions of reasonableness that are considered acceptable in regard to the existence of an external world and a unitary self on the one hand, and those which should obtain in regard to the existence of God on the other. In regard to both of the former, we have no demonstrative proof, yet the belief in their existence is held with certainty. So too, then, says the Rav, in regard to the existence of God, the religious experience itself should be adequate. Okay, here then is the Rav presenting a rational argument to show that it is reasonable to accept our consciousness of God as being truthful. I believe that the material presented here has been adequate to warrant the following conclusions. One, that according to the Rav, the epistemological basis of an individual's belief in God is, in the last analysis, it is not inferential arguments, it is not deductive proofs, but a person's own developed ontological awareness, which in the course of living the religious life brings him into contact with the living God. And secondly, this very idea. I mean, who says that this is enough, this is adequate to ground a belief in God? This very idea, says the Rav, that belief in God properly rests on personal experience, this can be justified by analogy to belief in a unified outside world and the unity of the self. Thank you.
What? You want to? If there are any questions, we can. Only urgent questions. They can entertain them now.
People feel that the Rav is unique? What do you say?
No. Each individual, in a suspension, feels that he's under the quotation was that he feels that he is unique.
Yes.
Is this a reflection of his perception of the deity? In other words, really, he is unique in that he perceives God only as no other living person does.
That I don't know whether he perceives, whether the uniqueness is in his perception of God. The uniqueness is, first of all, in his own feeling of the self. The I is unique. If Chazal said that Hashem was able to create every person different and unique. Now, the very subjective...
Maybe you should use the microphone.
The very subjective experience of an I, that in itself is part of the Tzelem Elokim. Because what is unique about Hashem is he's Anochi.
He says, "Anochi Hashem Elokecha." So what? Hashem is not a electrical force. Hashem is not a force. Hashem is pure subjectivity, and he has given to man, and that he creates every man b'tzelem elokim means every person is capable of feeling his subjective uniqueness. The I, b'she'enkei, there's no other kind of a form of life. All penguins, I mean, we have no idea, but it's doubtful that any penguin feels himself to be unique among the other penguins. So that, in that sense, man is unique. And